the CIA's point of view, how rare of an opportunity was that Malaysia meeting?
Extremely rare. Here you had real-time information, but you have an opportunity to intercept it and follow them and know what's going on.
The implications of the terror summit went well beyond the Kohl bombing. Attending the Malaysia meeting were two known al-Qaeda operatives who would be among the 9/11 hijackers.
Khaled al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi were rich kids from Mecca, and they had gotten into jihad. They were willing to be martyrs. CIA broke into Midhar's hotel room in Dubai, and they found his passport. And in the passport, they found a visa for the United States. The CIA knew he was coming to America even before he got here. Doug Miller said, this is important. I want to be able to inform the Bureau. So he drafted a memo to send over to the FBI.
Doug emails one individual, said, please hold off for now. That's when Doug comes up to me and says, hey, Mark, my cable's sitting in her queue. It's not going anywhere. Could you find out what the hell's going on? Yeah.
There was a senior CIA official.
Michelle.
Who I understand we're calling Michelle.
I said, hey. Michelle. Doug's cable. What's the deal? No, I'm not going to send it. Why not? Because it's a CIA matter. You follow terrorists halfway around the goddamn globe, you find out they have visas in their passport, and you don't tell the FBI? I want to know the answer to that question. I want some look me in the eye and tell me why Doug's
memo... We'll intervene whenever we decide it's in our national security interest to intervene. And if you don't like it, lump it.
The problem with America is not that we go around marauding around the world imposing ourselves. Mm-hmm. The problem with America in the last 10, 15 years since the end of the Cold War, really in the last 60 years, is that we've been too slow to get involved.
I don't know how many Iraqi civilians were killed, but I can assure you that the number is the absolute minimal that it's possible in modern warfare.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
You know, that land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
Welcome to the darkened hour.
January 5th, 2000. 12 Malaysian authorities from the special branch were surveilling a high-level al-Qaeda meeting in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. The high-rise condo in the town of Cheras was rented by Yazid Sufat. According to Chapter 1 of Graham's book, quote, the son of a Rupper Tavern, Sufat had won a scholarship to study at the government's prestigious Royal Military College. From there, he won another scholarship to continue his studies. This time, California State University in Sacramento, one of several thousand Malaysian students sent abroad annually to study. Upon returning home, Sufat founded a profitable laboratory analysis company built on government contracts and the Malaysian government's preferential treatment of Muslim-owned business. During that time, he was successful in his business enterprise and not a particularly devout Muslim, occasionally enjoying a beer. End quote. And then in 1993, he began to change. At the insistence of his wife, he began going to a mosque, an activity that furthered his interest in the Muslim roots and left him increasingly disillusioned with Malaysia's secular government. He began spending more and more time with militant Islamic teachers who told him that Muslims should take up arms and defend their brothers in Indonesia's Maluku Islands, where Christians and Muslims had been involved in bloody clashes. By all accounts, he was an eager recipient of such teachings. Seeing this enthusiasm, one of his teachers, who now police believe to be al-Qaeda's Southern East Asian operations chief, began tapping him for small assignments. January 2000, his assignment was to make his condominium available for a meeting that the United States now knew was about to take place. This meeting was held during a three-day period between January 5th to January 8th of 2000. Afterwards, the photos taken by the Malaysian Spatial Branch were faxed over to the Bin Laden Issue Station, codenamed Alex Station, under then-Chief Richard Blee. The CIA and the CIA Counterterrorism Center, or CTC, were now aware of those who attended the meeting. They included Khalid al-Midar, Nawaf al-Hazmi, Salim al-Hazmi, Fahad al-Kuso, Ridwan Isamuddin, known as Hambali, Zacharias Moussaoui, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, Walid bin Attash, also known as Khalad, and Abu Bara al-Taizi. There would be other people who provided public services but had not attended the meeting. Those would be Ahmad Saljuli Abdul Rahman, an operative of Jemaah Islamiyah, an Indonesian sect affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Saljuli takes to visiting Arabs around Kuala Lumpur. Ahmad Hikmat Shakir, a suspected Al-Qaeda agent of Iraqi nationality. Shakir is a greeter at the Kuala Lumpur airport. Here he meets Khalid al-Midar and travels with him to the apartment where the summit is held. Gideon Barkat, a.k.a. Abu Isa al-Hindi, is a British citizen of Indian descent. According to a 2006 Observer article, Barot is, quote, not believed to have been present at the summit meetings, end quote. However, he does go to Kuala Lumpur during the time of the summit with some attendees, Khalid Mawali bin Attash. Shortly after the summit, Barot holds meeting with Hambali. It will later be reported that Barot is sent by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to New York City in early 2001 to case potential targets there. Although, whether this is part of the 9/11 plot or some other plot is unclear. Though Alex Station, the CIA's Bin Laden unit, is coordinating with surveillance Al-Qaeda summit, it fails to draft a full report to alert the rest of the intelligence community. And one would ask why. Why would they fail to share information that could have been pertinent, but no one knows? Only they would know. People within that community. And people will say, well, didn't they have a right to share that information? Well, yes, they did. But clearly, they didn't. One in which a cable was read by certain FBI agents. However, it was not acted upon. Author James Mapper will comment, quote, despite the importance of the operation, Richard Blee had never bothered to write up and distribute an intelligence report on it, what is known as a telegraphic dissemination, also known as a TD. They would talk about this, why the threat matrix did not involve these two men. And the 9/11 Commission basically had this to say.
The intelligence community issued a threat advisory warning that the threat of impending Al-Qaeda attacks would likely continue indefinitely. The advisory cited threats in the Arabian Peninsula, Jordan, Israel, and Europe, and suggested that Al-Qaeda was lying in wait and searching for gaps in security before moving forward with the planned attacks. During the spring and summer of 2001, President Bush had occasionally asked his briefers whether any of the threats pointed to the United States. Reflecting on these questions, the CIA decided to write a briefing article summarizing its understanding of this danger. The article, which the President received on August 6th, is attached to this staff statement. Despite the large number of threats received, there were no specifics regarding time, place, method, or target. Disruption efforts continued. An Al-Qaeda associate from North Africa connected to Abu Zubaydah was arrested in the United Arab Emirates on August 13th. He had apparently been planning an attack against the U.S. Embassy in Paris. CIA analysts who have recently reviewed the threat surge of the summer of 2001 told us they believe it may have been related to a separate stream of events. These threats may have been referring to the 9/11 attack, the planned assassination of Northern Alliance leader Ahmad Shah Massoud, or other operations. In July 2001, the CSG alerted federal law enforcement agencies and asked the FAA to send out security advisories. Beginning on July 27th, the FAA issued several security directives to U.S. air carriers prior to September 11th. In addition, the FAA issued a number of general warnings about potential threats, primarily overseas, to civil aviation.
Lee must have been aware of the operation's importance because he repeatedly briefs the CIA's leadership. These briefings are passed on to top government officials such as National Security Advisor Sandy Berger and FBI Director Louis Freeh. Senior intelligence officer will later say, quote, "A TD would have gone to a lot of people, but we didn't do that," end quote. This is just one of the reasons why three of the attendees at the meeting, which included future 9/11 hijackers Khalid Al-Mihdhar and Nawafal Hazmi, were able to apparently disappear in Thailand on January 8th as they left the meeting. Bamford will later call this failure a serious blunder. As of 2024, none of the photos have been made public, and information about them is scanty. However, the photos show Khalid Al-Mihdhar, Nawafal Hazmi, Isamuddin, Yazid Sufat, Walid bin Attash, Fahad Al-Kusso, Ramzi bin Al-Shib. None of these photos were passed on to either NSA or the National Security Council. A series of calls by Al-Qaeda operatives, some of whom are under surveillance by the CIA and the Malaysian Special Branch at this time, links three sites involved to the bombing of the USS Cole. Even though the CIA is aware of the calls, it would later say it is unable to find the hijackers in Bangkok. The location of one of the sites.
The intelligence community issued a threat advisory.
And that's the reason why many people failed to report on this within the CIA. They had enough information, and it was brought up by Timothy Romer.
Mr. Black, let me ask you. Your folks did a very professional job following people into Kuala Lumpur to a meeting of known, suspected thugs, terrorists, murderers. Then, after the meeting of a couple days in Kuala Lumpur, they leave, three of them leave, and go to Bangkok. You fail to follow those three people. To me, that's like a sheriff in a local town finding some people on the border of Indiana that are suspected murderers, letting them go across the border in Michigan and not alerting anybody that they're on their way. What happened? Where did we let down the guard here from Kuala Lumpur to Bangkok that then let two of these hijackers into the United States?
The activity covering these people in Kuala Lumpur was pretty comprehensive. We were concerned about their actions. We were able to conduct photography.
I said you did a good job there.
It played out later, so that was worked out pretty well. What happened was that when the targets departed Kuala Lumpur and went to Bangkok, that the advisory information, the alert to the people downrange in Bangkok, did not arrive in time to put coverage upon the targets upon arrival. Got there late. The targets went out into the community, and working with our friends locally as a priority operational activity, we tried to find these people. So we were looking for them in the interim, and the next sign of life that we identified of these targets, unfortunately, was looking at, I think, airport departure cards, something like that, some physical evidence that they had departed, and then that information was reported in cable traffic, which is another part of the story.
Series of calls made by the operatives. And Graham would also write about the initial failure of not disseminating information. George Tenet, then the director of Central Intelligence, would later testify to the joint inquiry Quote, we had at that point in January 2000, the level of detail needed to watch list Khalid al-Midar. That is, to nominate him to the State Department for refusal of entry into the United States or to deny him another visa. Our officers did not do so. The question becomes, why not? Why was this information withheld? What was the reason for this? And why did it take so long? What was the reason for withholding it from even just the principals or even from the State Department if they had their beefs with the FBI? Had the FBI been given this information, would there have been another outcome?
Presence of those two hijackers in San Diego and their intersection with the informant, obviously, a very fruitful opportunity for exploitation, intelligence information, maybe in the best of all circumstances, leading to prevention. It would have been helpful for the FBI at that particular point in time to know the names of those two individuals, that the information which was generated in the January 2000 physical surveillance, not by the CIA, but by a liaison agency, if that information and the initiation for that surveillance, which were phone calls to a central number, which you're well aware of, which plays a integral role not only in the East African bombings case, but also in the Cole investigation, the June meeting when three but not all of the photographs were disclosed to FBI agents, and the subsequent description of those events. If all of that had worked the way it could have worked, and that informant, as well as informants all over the FBI's domain, were tasked to find out information about two specific people, you could have had a completely different result.
And according to Graham in chapter one of his book, had the CIA placed Khalid al-Midar on the watch list in January 2000, he and possibly his companion Nawaf al-Hazmi would have been denied entry into the United States and detained for interrogation, hereby obviously disrupting the 9/11 operation. And maybe, just maybe, it would not have happened at all. Now, hey, I'm not saying that the CIA had intimate knowledge about the plane's operation. I'm just not going to go there. To also say that they didn't either, there simply is no direct evidence that they had such knowledge. That mistake in Malaysia was compounded by another in the United States upon receiving the photographs of Nawaf al-Hazmi Khalid al-Midar. The CIA did nothing. It failed to notify the State Department. The agency at that time maintained our largest watch list of suspected persons. Heck, even the Immigration National Relations Service was not notified and was therefore unable to deny entry at the border. No one knew nothing. The CIA also may have failed to notify the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which, had it known of the significance and the likely imminent presence inside the United States of these al-Qaeda operatives, would have placed one of them under surveillance. I think that would have been the obvious. And probably, easily, could have gave up information, additional information, to capture everybody else. But don't just believe what I have to say. Here it comes for the Joint House Inquiry.
Proceed now to the June 11th, 2000 meeting. 2001 meeting, because that's what I really want to focus on, and then the events after that. But that's a bit of the background, and if I'm wrong in any of that, I would assume that our witnesses would correct me. On page 9 at the bottom of Ms. Hill's report. It stated the following. On June 11th, 2001, FBI headquarters representatives and CIA representatives met with the New York FBI agents handling the Cole investigation. The New York agents were shown but not given copies of the photographs that they and told that they were taken in Malaysia. They weren't told that. Still, information being withheld. This is after the Cole. Information withheld from the FBI. One of the New York agents recalled that Almidar's name was being mentioned. He also recalled asking for more information on why the people in the photographs were being followed. So we got an FBI now asking the CIA, why are you following these folks? He recalled asking for more information on why they were being followed and for access to that information. The New York agents were advised they could not be told why Almidhar and the others were being followed. This is truly unbelievable. I've got to tell you all, this is extraordinary. This has got nothing to do with information which can't cross a wall. This has to do with leads.
Leads, truly. At this point, you're probably thinking, the CIA is a bunch of snakes.
We got to clear the snakes out of the cockpit.
Yeah, clear the snakes out of the cockpit,
Enough is enough! I have had it with these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane!
And that's only the beginning of it. Graham would also note a third failure, if that wasn't enough. Quote, had the United States or Malaysian intelligence services continued to monitor the Kuala Lumpur condominium, in January of 2000. Getting ahead of myself. They would have seen another visitor. Zacharias Moussaoui, whose connection to the plot remains unclear, but who has been charged in the United States on 4 counts related to the September 11 attacks, conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism, conspiracy to commit aircraft piracy, conspiracy to destroy aircraft, and conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction. Not only did Yazid Soufat allow Moussaoui to stay there, he also eased Moussaoui's entry into the United States, providing a phony letter of employment listing Moussaoui as the overseas sales representative of his company in Focus Tech, end quote. Walid Binatash, Khalid Al-Madar, and Nawapa Hazmi would then travel to Bangkok, Thailand, when the meeting was over, where Binatash would disembark, allowing for Khalid Al-Madar and Nawapa Hazmi to get them on a connecting flight to Los Angeles International Airport. Landing on January 15th of 2000, still, the CIA did not inform the FBI or State Department about both men, known to be al-Qaeda by the NSA and the CIA, regarding the pair landing in the United States. Why? Why indeed? I mean, at this point, we're just sick and tired of asking why. Because at this point, I'm expecting a cover-up of major proportions. Heck, even the 9/11 Commission couldn't hide this glaring hole within the story of the CIA.
CIA official detailed to the International Terrorism Operations Section at the FBI wondered where the attacks might occur. We will call him John. John recalled the Kuala Lumpur travel of Midhar and his associates around the millennium. He searched the CIA's databases for information regarding the travel. On May 15th, he and another official at CIA re-examined many of the old cables from early 2000, including the information that Midhar had a U.S. visa and that Hazmi had come to Los Angeles on January 15, 2000. The CIA official who reviewed the cables took no action regarding these cables. She cannot recall this work. John, however, began a lengthy exchange with a CIA analyst to figure out what these cables meant. He recognized the relationship to the bombing case, and he was aware that someone had identified Khalid in one of the surveillance photographs from the Malaysia meeting. He concluded that something bad was definitely up. Despite the U.S. links evident in this traffic, John did not raise that aspect with his FBI counterparts. He was focused on Malaysia. John's focus on the overseas target area might be understood from his description of the CIA as an agency that tended to play a zone defense. In contrast, he said, the FBI tends to play man-to-man. Desk officers at the CIA's bin Laden station did not have cases in the same sense as an FBI agent who works something beginning to end. Thus, when the trail went cold after the Kuala Lumpur meeting in January 2000, the desk officer moved on to different things. By the time the March 2000 cable arrived with information that one of the travelers had flown to Los Angeles, the case officer was not responsible for following up on that information. While several individuals at the bin Laden station opened the cable when it arrived in March 2000, it was no one's concern and no action was taken.
Wait, there's more. More suspicious decisions were made by CIA personnel. Doug Miller, an FBI agent assigned to Alex Station, reads the CIA cable reporting that 9/11 hijacker Khalid Al-Mihdhar had a U.S. visa. And even drafts a cable to the FBI to inform of it. Because the domestic arm of the United States is not the CIA. They have no legal jurisdiction. The FBI does. CIA obtained the information through a tap on Al-Mihdhar's phone in Yemen. And by monitoring him as he passed through Dubai on his way to Al-Qaeda summit meeting in Malaysia. Another story regarding how CIA obtained Al-Mihdhar's passport is from an article by one of the 9/11 pre-Lebanon experts in Lawrence Wright, author of The Looming Tower. Quote, the CIA did share the information with Saudi authorities, who told the agency that Al-Mihdhar and a man named Nawaf al-Hazmi were members of Al-Qaeda based on this intelligence. The CIA broke into their hotel room in Dubai, where both men were staying en route to Malaysia. The operatives photocopied Al-Mihdhar's passport and faxed it over to Alex Station. Inside, the passport was the critical information that Khalid Al-Mihdhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi had U.S. visas. The agency did not alert the FBI or the State Department so that Khalid Al-Mihdhar's name could not be put on a terrorist watch list. Would have prevented him from entering the United States at all, end quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I say to you, whatever scenario you end up believing, there remains one constant. The CIA intentionally withheld pertinent information from the FBI under John O'Neill, which very well could have had the FBI detain and arrest two known Al-Qaeda operatives in Khalid Al-Mihdhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi because they were seen with the alleged planner of the USS Cole bombing, for which the FBI had jurisdiction, Waleed bin Attash, while at the summit meeting in Malaysia. Wait, that wasn't even all. The CIA's bin Laden issues station, under its chief Richard Blee, would make another suspicious decision. Again, we go back to Doug Miller from the New York City Field FBI office, that he would react to the cable regarding Al-Mihdhar and al-Hazmi and immediately began a CIR draft, Central Intelligence Report, meaning, and detailed the findings while sharing copies of the visa and the passport. However, since it is CIA information, they did need approval. This was passed to the bin Laden issue station deputy chief Tom Wilshire, who reads the draft and has Michelle Ann Casey, the CIA's lead analyst for the Al-Qaeda communications hub in Yemen, to respond to Doug Miller's request by putting on the email draft, quote, please hold off per Wilshire, end quote. Ah, this is truly fucking unbelievable. Two known Al-Qaeda operatives. Now remember, the CIA said we are at war with Al-Qaeda in 1999. Two known Al-Qaeda operatives heading to LAX Airport, Los Angeles International, and the draft warning the Department of Justice about two dangerous individuals are not to be shared with the lead domestic agency. The fuck on earth for? Casey then drafts a cable falsely saying that the information about Khalid Al-Mihdhar and his visa have been shared with the FBI, and that there will be a discussion the next day about whether the cable should be sent. However, there's a problem. The Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General will later call the failure to pass the information to the FBI a significant failure, but will be unable to determine why the information was not passed on. What more head-shaking nonsense? The 9/11 Commission will know of the incident, but will relegate it to an end note in its final report, omitting Wilshire's role entirely. Talk about a fucking whitewash. The CIA's Inspector General falsely claimed that the cable was not sent, apparently because it was in the wrong format or needed editing. What the fuck were the CIA actively trying to hide here? Mark Rossini, an FBI agent on loan to Alex Station, protests in vain against a decision to deliberately withhold information about one of the hijackers, Khalid Al-Madar. He speaks with Casey, who listens and responds in kind. Quote, look, the next attack is going to happen in Southeast Asia. It's not the Bureau's jurisdiction. We want the FBI to know about it, we'll let them know. But the next Bin Laden attack is going to happen in Southeast Asia. You are to not share that information with the FBI, end quote. It will be alleged that after 9/11, that the notification may be withheld to stop the FBI interfering with an illegal CIA-linked operation to monitor the hijackers in the United States. This is not speculation because it would turn out to be true, of course, through the declassification in 2021 of Executive Order 14040, known as Operation Encore, and through the Canastrero investigation from the Guantanamo Office of Military Commissions, in which Canastrero personally interviewed former CIA, FBI, and 9/11 congressional officials who saw classified intelligence that speaks of a very covert CIA Saudi intelligence operation that surveilled both Khalid Al-Madar and the Waffle Hazmi while knowing they were Al-Qaeda while living inside the United States, with Saudi intelligence operators providing financial and logistical support to both men. An elaborate and highly illegal operation could have witnessed the arrest and or firing of the DCI himself, George Tenet, and maybe even the CIA's Director of Operations, James Pabot, who definitely would have known about such an operation itself. But what about holding people responsible? Isn't that what this has always been about? I mean, what else are we in this for? To get clicks? Profit? Maybe even make a fictional courtroom film? But the 9/11 Commission even covered this, as well as the Joint House Inquiry.
Hey, General, what does accountability mean to you, sir?
There's a difference between a job not being done.
Absolutely.
And a job being done in a slipshod way.
That's right.
And I think what Director Tenet was pointing out, that the issues that this committee and our dialogue has uncovered are systemic issues, that we put people in situations in which they had inadequate tools or inadequate circumstances to succeed.
But not always. Now, we've had, General, we'll all concede that you need more resources. And we've worked with you, Senator Graham and other members of the committee, to revamp as a priority NSA, and you're working toward that
right.
goal. We have to. It's national.
Sir.
We've worked with Director Tenet.
Yes, you have.
I'm not on the Judiciary Committee or the Criminal Justice Appropriations, but I know others have worked in that regard. I know you don't have too many resources, but a lot of this is decisions that people make or fail to make. Director Tenet.
Well, sir, let me just say.
What does responsibility, accountability mean to you?
Well, sir, when you look at this, I look at it in the following ways. I look at anybody's performance.
Sure.
I say, tell me about the integrity of the individual, how hard they were working. Tell me about their understanding of their job. Tell me about whether they were slipshod. Tell me about whether they were paying attention to detail and doing everything they knew how to do. Now, when somebody
stop you a minute. Let me just say, in knowing everything they knew how to do, but what if you had people in these jobs that didn't know what they were doing and didn't know the standard? And I know some people at the Bureau, we had testimony here, didn't know the FISA standard, even lawyers over there, Director Mueller. I'm not saying it's your fault. I'm just saying that they're inadequately trained. Go ahead, Director Tenet. I'll try not to stop you again.
No, it's okay, sir. Keep going. I lost my train of thought. I apologize.
Maybe you'll pick it up again.
I was on a roll.
No, you thought you were. You weren't on a roll.
No, I was on a roll, sir.
I don't think so. Director Mueller, what is your feeling How do you feel about the word accountability, the term accountability? Is that responsibility?
I think it's giving people both the responsibility and the authority to do a job, to set out parameters, what you expect from people, and if they do not live up to those parameters, then you hold them, quote, accountable. You move them, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
But it is the ultimate accountability is me.
I
have to set those standards. I have to give them the tools to do the job. It does not make any sense for me to hold somebody accountable if I have not been given them the responsibility, the authority, and the tools to do the job. That is just that's wrong. And so in terms of something like the training on the FISA issue, it's a responsibility of me to assure when I see something like that, that we put into place the mechanisms to get those individuals trained. If we did not give them the training, I cannot hold accountable that person who was inadequately trained because I did not provide the person with that training.
I'm your co-host, Adam Fitzgerald of the Dark Endowment. Thank you for tuning in.